So, Bob, I have a lot of emails and questions on Facebook directed toward you, and I thought that we would roll through those. I got 10 pages of questions and notes that I want to finish in this episode. So we got to rapidly fire through these. What do you say?
Let's fire through. We never do, but...
I know. We never do. This is the Psychology in Seattle podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a therapist, a professor, and a fast podcaster aspirationalist. Who are you, Berto? Bob.
Yeah, I'm Bob. I'm your friend from graduate school 100 years ago, a therapist in practice here in Seattle. And I was thinking on my drive into work today, I have never said how grateful I am to you for letting me come on here and talk with you. I really like doing this.
Well, I'm grateful to you too, Bob.
Yeah, thanks.
Mostly, honestly, because it just gives me a chance to hang out with you more often than we would have otherwise,
right.
I think.
It's true.
And the listeners love you.
Oh, well, that's
nice. I mean, it's unanimous. And I want to remind you and the listeners that 11 years ago when I set forth on this podcast, I originally wanted it to be me and Bob.
Yeah.
Bob said absolutely not because he was shy. And I just went to my next best friend, which was Umberto. But Umberto was like a distant second because he's not a clinician. And so I thought, well, I don't know, maybe he'll be like the funny guy on the podcast. And, you know, things worked out.
Yeah.
But clearly, if you would have joined me in the beginning, think of the mountains we could have climbed. Okay, first question from top fan Patrick on Facebook. He says, hearing from Bob always means a lot to me.
Oh.
I feel like I can relate to Bob the most.
Hmm.
It's not a question.
No.
It's just a thing to say.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think that makes sense given your ability to talk about your own experience, attachment-wise, insecurity-wise.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it's universal insecurity.
Indeed.
So
this is a really important point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's so great to hear people talk about it. Like Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend podcast. He will sometimes get into how Conan himself and the guests or What the Fuck podcast with Mark Maron, also another guy who likes to get into it with. And these are celebrities. These are guys at the top of their game.
Yeah.
Who have achieved everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, they go to sleep at night, like worrying about the stupid shit that they said, just like everyone else does. Howard Stern is actually like that as well.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it's nice to know that no matter how high you climb, you're still just an insecure boob. Sarah on Facebook says, I know you've covered it before, but I find his knowledge on borderline and DBT fascinating.
Oh.
Challenges of group therapy, Bob, is what she wants to know. What are the challenges of group therapy?
Oh, good question. Now, when she says group therapy, I think she means DBT skills class.
And I think group therapy in general.
Okay.
You know.
I have very little experience doing group therapy. I haven't done that probably since school.
At process group therapy,
which, by the way, guys, I think is really, boy, good group therapy is really good.
Yeah.
Really good.
Yeah. Famous patron Emily in Philadelphia does that kind of work. We've had her on the podcast before, and she's talked about her own experience as a client and also as a clinician and how powerful it can be.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, what are the challenges of DBT class group leading?
Striking a balance between acceptance of a person where they are and a pull for change. That's always a moving target. And how to validate.
Not going too fast.
Yeah.
Not like accusing them of having feelings that are invalid or something.
Oh, never that. Yeah, right.
But, you know.
But, right.
As you challenge, like, so, you know, let's evaluate that feeling and that reaction.
Right.
There's a risk. You're going to step on a landmine where the person's going to feel like you are basically saying their feelings are invalid and that they're invalid.
Yeah.
And that's a very obviously trauma triggering notion, given that they were rejected for everything growing up, including their feelings. So that's what you're saying, that balance of like meet them where they are
and
what's the next step forward, but not two steps forward.
Oh, yeah.
But what about group dynamics? I mean, I'm sure you deal with that a lot.
Well, you know, we're set up so that we minimize the impact of group dynamics. We have a specific rule that there will be no judgment or criticism of one another in the class, that comments that clients or that students make to one another are supportive and helpful only when asked. And so my groups tend to be spontaneously supportive of one another. And we have a specific rule that we will assume the best intent in each other. So there is no kind of challenging crosstalk that would take place in a process group. Crosstalk is the wrong way to put it, but we don't do that because it has the potential to undermine our main goal together, which is to learn and practice skills. And so we're not a process group, and I tell them that up front. And then I just put brackets around, I think I've gotten so good at it, it rarely happens. People actually like coming. Mm-hmm. So they don't get in scrapes with one another, and they often feel very safe and therefore very supportive and therefore in many ways unguarded. And so their defenses don't come up because, you know, they're among friends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That sounds like a wonderful group to go to.
Yeah.
I, you know, imagine that there are times when you're preparing for group mentally anyway.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, I got to get my head in the game because to do individual therapy, it's often less of a emotional outlay, right? When you do groups or teaching, I mean, maybe you're closer to a professor like me in that I got to gear up my energy. I know I'm going to deal with at least one or two students that have facial expressions that are challenging to me. Uh-huh. You know, there's always that one student who just has like resting disapproval face, you know? And I always point them out too. Like I had a student for a couple of years, and I would frequently be like, I don't know exactly how I'd phrase it, but I said something like, oh, you know, resting disapproval face, what's going on there?
Nice.
Which, you know, it's hard. And so I just imagine for you that as you're teaching the class, there's amount of energy you got to get up. There's always like one or two students who are a little harder to connect with, a little bit more to manage. Is that a challenge?
Yeah, it is. Being curriculum driven, there's less of that. I teach a curriculum, so there's less focus on individual student experience, and the way people generally talk about things is just in terms of skills. So I probably have a little bit of a structural advantage in that. So we don't really get into too much what is the experience, though. One of the things that I've learned from experience and also just from watching you is humility. And I do indeed fuck up sometimes. And the last time I fucked up, I got impatient with one of my students and I said something, you know, kind of shitty, really. Judgmental, critical. And, you know, as soon as I do that, it doesn't register just with the one person, it registers with everybody. But for this person that I said it to, it took about 45 minutes for it actually to impact her. As soon as I said it, I'm like, oh, shit. I screwed up.
Yeah.
And so what I did is it's something I've learned to do and I've gotten good at and is absolutely necessary is I simply just publicly apologized to her. I said, you know what? That sucked. I shouldn't have said that to you and I'm really sorry. And if you have feelings about this and you want to talk about it, we certainly can. And she did. But at the end of the class. And she was really pissed off at me and rightfully so. And so I just reiterated, yep, makes sense. I did misstep and you have every right to feel the way you feel. I don't tell people they have the right to feel the way they feel because of course they do. It's pedantic.
Makes sense that they feel that way.
Yeah, really. It makes sense that you feel that way and I feel bad about it and I'm very sorry. And your experience here is really important and I want us to repair if we can. The other students remarked to me that was really helpful to them to see somebody model remorse. And also, that's pretty much what they said to me.
Yeah, it's amazing. In the moment, did you apologize? Like,
oh,
right
fuck
away?
Yeah. As soon as it came out of my mouth, I'm like, oh, buddy, you just misstepped.
Oh, man. It's harder for me to do that than you, I think. when I do that in class, because we have students who also have, you know, personality disorders as a result of relational traumas.
Yeah, sure.
And there will be moments where I'll do something, I'll misstep inadvertently.
Yeah.
And then realize I must have misstepped. And there's this, if they were an individual client, I'd immediately stop because we have the time to kind of luxuriate.
Right.
If I focus on them, it's not going to take away from anything else.
Right.
When I'm teaching a class, I'm like, well, I can't bog down in this because I have 15 other students
right.
that are paying good money for a class.
Right.
And honestly, you know, it's not my fault that I didn't know the person had this sensitivity,
yeah.
right?
Right.
Because it's not like now, if I say something blatantly stupid or hurtful or yeah. something like that, then obviously I'd apologize.
Sure,
but
of course.
But I'm just thinking about a thing that happened, like, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago. And,
yeah.
And I had apparently stepped on a landmine uh-huh. with a student, and she started to cry in class.
Mm-hmm.
But she also indicated that she did not want to talk about it mm-hmm. at all. She's just like, I don't want to talk about it, you know, mm-hmm. and it was a tense moment and felt really terrible for me,
course.
You know, and I could tell the other students were like, what's going on?
Sure.
You know, it wasn't intuitive as to why the person was hurt, mm-hmm. you know, and again, in individual therapy, I'd say, well, okay, what's going on here?
Yeah.
You don't want to talk about it. What do you want to, you know, I just yeah. really kind of
stay with
focus
yeah.
and not just turn away and
right.
act like nothing happened,
right.
which is what I kind of did, you know what I
sort
mean?
Sort of. I mean, right. A person could experience it that way.
Yeah, you know, and it just, because I've been in a position as a student at times where the professor will turn to that one student, and I, as a fellow student, am like, I'm paying money for you to
yeah.
tend to that person's landmines?
Yeah.
Like, no. Like, yeah. deal with this outside of class.
Right.
Like,
right.
I'm paying money for this. Teach me something.
Right.
I know what it looks like when I don't know. I'm always just, so, and I have to make that calculation, like, within a half a second, standing in front of a group of people.
Oh,
you know what I mean?
Oh, yes, I do.
Yeah.
That is tense, man. That's a lot of balls to juggle. Heart
yeah.
rate's up and everybody else's heart rate is up. And
yeah.
Whew,
and just
inspiring.
Yeah, just that cringe feeling.
Oh,
you have.
It's terrible.
Sarah has another question from Facebook. Success stories of people who have moved toward healthier relationships.
Shit, that's on the spot. It happens. But success story. Okay. Okay. I'm drawing a blank off the top of my head.
Well, how about yourself?
Oh, okay. Yeah. How about me?
I mean, you're a success story who's moved towards a healthier relationship.
Yes, that's true. Well, you know, Colleen and me, both trauma survivors, and the way the trauma shows up, it's almost daily in some way, usually little avoidances.
Like what?
Like we get engrossed in the television.
Okay.
And we're sort of parallel but not connecting.
Do you feel the distance in those moments?
Yeah, and I think I'm probably more sensitive to it. I probably read into it more than she does. She likes it when we're together and nothing's demanded of her and it's quiet and she feels safe.
Yeah.
And that's her safe place. And me, I've been thinking about you a lot this week because you said to me a couple weeks ago, well, yeah, you're kind of a pursuing type or you kind of have a preoccupied style, which I do. And I've been watching my preoccupied style show up at work, not since this morning, but nonetheless. And it shows up in Colleen, with Colleen, in that I can be there with her and not see her as a person who's appreciating this quietness, but think, oh shit, what aren't we talking about? Oh shit, what aren't we talking about?
Yeah.
And the thing I think about, I do what anybody would do, is I focus on what aren't we talking about, as opposed to, oh, I'm anxious right now.
Mm.
I probably need some reassurance that everything's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I have asked for that. There's times when I ask for that, but it's fairly autopilot to fall into that.
Yeah.
And also very common.
To maybe say something like, so we're just going to sit here and watch fucking TV all night, or?
Yeah, I could crab at it, which is probably more my bent than to be sort of like validating and assertive, which is like, hey, I'm anxious.
Yeah.
Can you reassure me that we're good?
That's tough though, you know, because it sounds easy to do, but
sounds easy.
It's hard.
It is
in
hard.
The moment.
Yeah.
We all have our pride, which is a lot stronger than I think most of us would like to admit.
Yeah.
We also have our paranoia
yeah.
that like, well, is this the moment when they really do hate me, uh-huh. you know? Also, you know, I imagine for someone in Colleen's position, just the, even if you did the most healthiest bid for reassurance, would still be a little bit of a labor that is what she's trying to avoid. Or there's landmines in the bid that yeah. she's like, oh shit, here we go.
Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't heard anything yet, but we've been here before. Heart right. rate goes up.
Right. Heart rate goes up.
Can't we just sit here and watch TV without having to talk about it? You know,
yeah.
like I wonder like, yeah. you know, that's a hard thing to navigate.
The dynamic. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So the success story is that, back in your 20s, you were still recovering. You're in therapy. But you know, more reactive.
Yeah.
But lots of therapy, lots of couple therapy.
Yeah.
Lots of attachment, discovery.
Yeah.
A lot of whys in the road where you choose the healthy direction yeah. and it goes well.
Yeah.
A lot of humility and falling on your sword and,
yeah,
and giving up on certain hangups like I need to be the smart, mature, sane one. and ironically, gain so much more respect from others around you, you know, the holding on to this notion of emotional perfection you know, the Steve McQueen, the strong, silent type,
how
the Clint Eastwoods, that's like, oh, it's so cool that, you know, he's like that. And how much pride
sure.
these guys would have, right? And it's like, oh, if I could only achieve that. And in fact, the opposite is true. Listening to an interview with Terry Crews, you know, he's...
Oh, yeah,
Terry
you know Crews. Him?
Yeah, he's from... If you don't know him out there, he's from Brooklyn...
Brooklyn
Nine-Nine.
Yeah.
He was also the president in Idiocracy.
I didn't see that.
Oh, he's also the big, buff, black guy from the Old Spice commercials. Uh-huh.
Wait. Look at your man. Now look at me.
Not that.
No, that guy's
the suave.
The suave guy.
But the big, angry, uh-huh. and his head explodes. And anyway, that's Terry Crews. He was on, What the Fuck podcast with Marc Maron. He was also on Hot Ones Challenge, the Hot Ones Challenge that you did on the podcast.
Oh, right.
During our, was that our anniversary? No.
Yeah.
Was that our anniversary?
11th?
No.
1,000th episode. That's what it
1,000th
was.
Episode, yeah.
Yeah.
And Terry Crews, he's an NFL football player. He played, you know, in the NFL, linebacker like me, by the way, which I respect quite a bit. And, you know, buff, tough guy, you know, often plays roles where, you know, he's a tough guy. He was a bouncer. He was for like Ice Cube for a while. you know, he's like the epitome of masculinity.
Uh-huh.
And he talks about, you know, how he was sexually harassed during the Me Too movement by an agent at his agency at a big of a party. Like they just grabbed this guy just grabbed his junk and how humiliated he felt, you know, and how men, so not only how men can be sexually harassed, which is obvious,
right.
but how a giant buff black guy who could crush your skull and has a persona of masculinity and power can instantly be made to feel small and insignificant. So Bob, I wasn't recording the last 20 minutes of our conversation.
Pearls of wisdom.
let's take a break and when we get back, I don't know, let's reset or something.
All right.
So So yeah, listeners, if you're listening to the bit just before that, basically what's happening, long story short, I don't have my usual backup recording setup available. And so I periodically will stop the recording just to make sure I'm capturing everything. And so I stopped the recording. I thought I restarted it. I did not restart it. Bob and I had a 20-minute conversation about Buddha. I teared up. Bob teared up. We talked more about Terry Crews. That'll just be lost to the ether.
Oh, they missed it. Pearls of wisdom.
But to summarize what I was and what you were saying was that I was talking about Terry Crews and about how he is able to be vulnerable and that to shed his pride of masculinity to be the strong, silent type like Clint Eastwood and Steve McQueen, if you're old enough to remember him from Bullet, for example, and The Great Escape, is a unhealthy way to live as a man. And Terry Crews, the manliest of all men, exhibits the manliness of all men's way of emoting and admitting his own vulnerability. And he talks about his wife. I don't know if I got that on the recording,
you
but...
did.
He talks about how he needs to be vulnerable to his wife and how he needs to know his own emotions and this kind of thing. And so I highly recommend listening to the WTF interview with Terry Crews and Marc Maron. And then we were talking about safety and I was talking about how, for me, how do we achieve safety? You brought that up or something. And, it's how do we achieve safety in relationships?
Right.
And it's a frequent thing. And the thing that I was saying was that for me and my wife, occasionally what I will want is reassurance that she's thinking about me, that she cares, that I'm a priority, that she has warm feelings, that it's not manufactured, that it's real, it's from the heart. And that and so the question that I'll say to her will be, so do you still love me?
Right.
You know, or I'll say, how much do you love me? Mm-hmm. You know, just out of the blue. Because I'll have an upwelling of whatever, some kind of need for reassurance in that way, which is normal. And she responds well to that.
Meaning she recognizes that this question, while playful, also has something deep and meaningful behind it.
Right.
And she responds to you because...
Right. And the reason why she knows partially is because early in our relationship, I explained that to her. I said, so when I ask you that question, it's actually kind of deeper than that. It's actually, I'm probably having some kind of insecure moment that I really need you to step up to the plate with if you can, because it'll really put me in a better mood.
So like a mature conversation about feelings and reassurance.
Yeah.
Nice.
And gushy stuff.
Gushy stuff.
And then we were talking about how ultimately, for me anyway, the acceptance, you know, safety also is established in part with the acceptance that at the end of the day, we're still basically alone, that our deeper fantasies of closeness and security and safety will never really be achieved in the way that we had it when we got it from our parents, particularly our mothers when we were, you know, 6, 9, 12 months old. We're breastfeeding, we're in their arms, we're looking into their eyes. Our mothers are totally attuned. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to exclude males from this as well. Obviously, you know, gay couples can have this as well. Whoever
or
is that,
just dads.
Yeah. But, you know, the act of breastfeeding is particular, or the act of feeding, I'll just say that. Yeah. Just that, you know, that if you've ever had a young child, you know what it is. You're holding the child skin to skin, you're feeding the child, and especially if you're breastfeeding, there's a eye contact. Mm-hmm. You know every single emotion that this little creature has. The creature looks up to the caregiver. There's no boundary between caregiver and child. They're one unit, and the child feels that, and the child feels safe and warm and taken care of and satiated and known and seen and safe.
And mom has a release of oxytocin.
Yeah, and child too. Yeah.
So bonding hormone.
Yeah, right. In a way that is powerful.
Yeah, visceral.
Yeah. But to the child, it's beyond anything we could possibly imagine as an adult. And yet we all are trying to return there, I think, on some level.
Yeah.
And yet we will never return there.
Not like that. But you said something important. You said, well, maybe we have moments when we're making love or we're at a wedding and it's really powerful and meaningful and we have moments of connection.
Yeah, right.
And then we ended up talking about, yeah, we're all alone and how we kind of have to live with that. And we ended up talking about the Buddha. The first noble truth is all life is dissatisfying. And how that gets translated into English is all life is suffering, but that's not really accurate. Sanskrit, all life is dissatisfying, and how we optimally can be okay with not being okay.
Yeah. And I forget when you and I started to tear up, but it was somewhere in there somewhere. So anyway, I think that was a
summary.
Yeah, it's a good enough facsimile of our a recreation of our previous conversation that went on for a while. All right, another question from top fan Jenna. She says, I'll listen to you all day, Bob.
Tell Colleen.
I would love to hear about formative experiences for you or other life-changing moments in your life that have made you who you are.
Oh, well. Well, contextual. My friendship with you. And I've said this on the podcast before.
Wow.
One of the reasons that you're such a meaningful and important person to me and that I really love you is I am so self-conscious and so scared all the time and filled with shame. And I watch you and look, I know that this isn't the whole of you, right? But there is a part of you that does not apologize for how you feel, for what you want, for what you do. And me, it's like there's a part of me that always wants to apologize. And one of the best things I've gotten from you, I have two friends that are like this, you and then my other friend Keith, is just having a model of it's okay to be you. Mm. So
that's for, and I remember early in our relationship, yeah. You would tell me something like
uh-huh,
that.
Yeah.
And it was so bizarre to me because when we met, you've always been older, but the age difference was more distinct when we were in our 20s.
Oh, yeah, right.
And I looked up to you.
Oh, shit.
You were smarter than I was. Mm. You were a better therapist than I was. You were, I don't know, in a lot of ways more social and dynamic and, you know, I sort of glommed onto you and your friends, you know.
Oh, yeah, right. Oh, that was so fun.
Keith being one of them,
Keith,
right?
Yeah, Keith, good guy.
So when you would say that to me, yeah. You'd be like, you know, I just really, mm-hmm. you know, respect that you just have a mm-hmm. way that you don't, you know, the shadow to this is narcissism, which is to be too into yourself.
Oh, we got to work that in.
But, you know, the positive side, yeah. The light side is a assuredness or yeah. a non-apologeticness.
Right.
You know, and quite different from what I've discovered in you as we've done the schema therapy episodes of a deep part of yourself that you're quite just baseline ashamed of who you are.
Yeah.
Like you have this schema that's really quite common yeah. for people where you believe that there's something deeply just flawed about you.
Yeah.
And if people really got to know you, they wouldn't really like you,
yeah.
Which is heartbreaking, and you know. Mm-hmm. But I remember you telling me that in the past, and thinking, "Huh, well, okay, I can do that for Bob. You know, I can model that. You know."
Well, you were just going to be you, anyways. I think. Did it put pressure on you?
No. But I think at times I did pour it on a little bit.
You know shit.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's interesting.
I think. I mean, it sounds familiar to me.
Yeah, if a little is good, a lot is more.
And, you know, there were times when you and I were kind of in the foxhole together, if you will.
Oh, yeah.
And so I kind of knew that if I stepped up,
uh-huh.
you would step up with me.
We did many times.
Yeah.
Good. Those are fun days. Hey, do you remember our first date?
First date?
Yeah. It was after class. It was probably first quarter, maybe second quarter. And we were leaving class and Laura and Annette were going to come out with us and we were going to go to the sit and spin and they both bagged.
Oh.
And it was just you and me. And I'm like, oh shit, it's just you and me. Like, is this going to be fun? Can I relate to you? Are you going to be able to relate to me? You know, and we ended up, the Sit and Spin, remember that place?
Yeah.
Yeah. We ended up having a really nice evening. It was really fun. Had a couple of beers and chatted after class.
Well, for those who don't know, Sit and Spin was kind of a main sort of venue in Seattle, Belltown, back when Belltown was grungy.
Yeah.
And Sit and Spin was a laundromat slash bar. Mm-hmm. Now it's like a donut coffee place, I think. Mm. And they actually would have bands in the back too. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Didn't you play there?
No.
No. Oh, we went there for a show.
Yeah. It was actually Chris Glover's cousin's band Reef. They're from England and they were touring and, I've talked about this in the podcast before where I talked with the lead singer, because he was living my life, you know. It's like, oh my God, you have a hit song that's, you know, going global, you're touring, you know, what's your contract like? What does your future look like? And he said, well, I'm making no money from the album because all the proceeds goes toward the label, the first album. Two, I'm making something like $35,000 a year, which I was like, that sucks. Three, I'm touring all the time, which is kind of a pain in the ass. And four, if I don't have another hit song, which they didn't, by the way, then this was just a flash in the pan moment that kind of distracted me maybe from my career options. And I remember just being like, what the fuck? I mean, this guy had a regular rotation on MTV, his video. And I thought, okay, I guess that, because there was no way I was even going to achieve that. But I thought, you know, if I got 5% in that direction, maybe, you know, it'd be something great. And so that's when I switched to just treating music as a hobby. And,
learning.
Yeah, which has really saved maybe my love for it. But anyway, yeah, our first date, you know, I'm sorry to say I don't remember that.
Oh, yeah.
I only remember going to Sit and Spin only that one time when we went to that show.
Yeah.
But I do remember going out with you and Annette and Laura often.
Yeah. They were fun.
And I remember us being like, you know, school friends that would maybe have a beer after class. But then it wasn't until we were about to graduate or something when we became fast friends.
I don't remember when that happened. It was, right? I finished school in June, but we were friends then.
Yeah.
And I remember that winter. No, that was the next one.
So this is 1997, if people are keeping track.
Yeah. Well, at some point along the way, you started coming to play poker with the Michael and Beth and the whole gang.
Yeah.
And the Todd.
I think it was something around there in 97. Yeah. Todd wasn't a part of the group at first.
No, he wasn't.
He joined later.
Yeah.
It was
really?
Mike, Beth, Keith's spouse.
Yeah.
And the Jaworskis occasionally.
Not very often.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it was mainly you, Mike, Beth, Keith, and Keith's
sitting
spouse.
Sitting in that apartment at Michael and Beth's in the district.
Yeah, and we'd play poker. And
and Bish.
Yeah, right, and Bish, yeah. And the wonderful thing about this group that I loved was that I grew up playing poker with my dad. My dad and his Japanese American friends once a month would play poker until, you know, the early morning, and they played, you know, five card, stud, you know, they played all the games.
Yeah.
And my dad would sit us down and we would play as well. I have very warm memories. But when you're playing with a real card player, you got to play cards. You got to do your responsibilities. You got to bet when your bet is up. You got to ask for the right cards. You can't play around.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
you can't be distracted. You can't have side conversations, really. You can't get up and watch TV. You got to stay focused at the game.
Yeah.
Whenever I would try to wrangle my friends, similar to me trying to wrangle my friends to play Dungeons and Dragons, it never went the way that I was hoping it would go. Because my friends, they'd get distracted, and I was constantly like, it's your bet. Okay, it's your bet. No, you can't do that. It's five to you. You can't raise. No, you can't. We're playing five card draw. You know, like, it's just a constant, you know, I have to be like a hawk.
Den mother.
On, you know, six people's playing. Yeah. And I have to watch everything they do because they will, one, they will screw it up. And two, they won't do it because they'll be distracted.
Right.
I played with you guys.
Yeah.
And every one of you guys was a hardcore card player.
Yeah.
Like me.
Yeah.
And I was in heaven.
Yeah.
I never had to tell anyone what to do. Occasionally, someone would be distracted and the whole table would descend on that person and just be like, Keith, what the fuck? I'm sorry. You know, and that would be the last time it would happen. And I was like, oh my God. And by the way, we would play all night long, lose. The biggest loser back then would lose like $5.
$5.
And they would be devastated.
Oh, yeah. That was when I learned that the money was inconsequential. The money was a marker for how well you did.
Kind of, but you know, $5 was kind of a thing back then.
Yeah, I was on student loans.
Yeah.
I had no money, right?
Yeah, that was not a joke, you know. No. $5 was a thing. Anyway, and, you know, all those guys became all my best friends.
Yeah, great guys.
Yeah, they were just fantastic people.
Yeah.
Cliff, too, right?
Oh, yeah, Cliff, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah, just from 97 to 2000 or something, it's like we probably spent 2 or 3 days a week together.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I used to live at your house.
Yeah.
Two, 3 days a week, yeah.
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 And so it was good times. Anyway, but give us another formative moment for Jenna, like from before, you know, maybe when you were a kid or something. What, you know, formative could mean anything, right? Life-changing moment.
Yeah. I suck at these kinds of things.
Yeah.
It takes me a sec to kind of
just what about like the first time you got dumped or the first time you fell in love?
Kathy Rickey. Yeah, Kathy Rickey. I met her when I was in ninth grade. We were both in the band together. We played clarinet and we were in the marching band together. And she was next to me and she's the first girl that ever hugged me, right? And from then on, I was sort of smitten, right?
How old were you? What grade?
I was in ninth grade. She was in 10th. And I pined for her because she wasn't interested in me other than we were good friends. And we were good friends. We had the same circle of folks.
Are you friends with her on Facebook?
No, this was a little couple of days before Facebook. And at the winter concert when I was a junior, she was sitting next to me in the band, right? We're going to do our show. And she had a little booger right on the end of her nose. And I thought it was so cute. You know, normally, but I was just like, that's kind of cute.
Wow. That's true love,
that's
man.
That's love, man.
I mean, if you think bugs are cute.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's interesting. So
formative, yeah.
So how was it formative to you? Like, was it like, oh, this is what this feels like? Or?
Well, yeah, actually, it was a really depressing time because, you know, you pine for somebody who's not interested in you and she ends up dating your friend. And it's like, oh, God.
She dated
so
your friend?
Crunching. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, because we were all in the same group, right? So she dated Rob.
Did she know you liked her?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I went through hell over this. And really, in a disorganized way, you know, it's like depressed and longing and sad and a little hangdog and pursuing.
Hangdog? What's hangdog?
You know, like
third wheel?
Woe is me.
Oh.
Yeah.
Was hangdog, is that a Pennsylvania thing?
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's not, apparently it's not a Seattle thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, she was never interested in me. And then something happened and God, I don't know what it was, but I just snapped out of it. When was it?
The booger?
No, it wasn't then. Was it? Maybe that was when I was a sophomore. The booger was when I was a sophomore. And when I was a junior in August of my junior year, you go to band camp. Two weeks of marching band in the fucking hot, humid Pennsylvania sun. It was miserable. But every day from 8 to 5 for 2 weeks. And I just snapped out of it. It just stopped. And I love her. She's great, you know? We're still buddies. So we're still good friends. But it just stopped.
Wow. So
I don't even know why.
But was this like a daily thing for you? Like,
oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I used to look at her school photo because, you know, that back in those days, you know, you get your portrait taken, your school photo portrait, and then you get the little minis and people pass them around. They write something on the back, you know. So I had hers. I used to just stare at it.
Were there any other girls that you were like, okay, no, just her.
Just her.
My God, you were ducky and pretty.
I was fucking imprinted on her.
You were ducky and pretty and pink.
I was ducky.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And your friend was McCarthy, who gets the girl.
That's right. That's right. Blaine. Blaine. Yeah. That's not a name. It's an appliance.
Yeah.
Line from the movie.
Yeah.
Anyways,
Anyways. Golly, I mean, I can, you know, I can feel that as you describe. I mean, just years of like
2 years
just being in love with someone, and you just look at their picture and their boogers even seem cute. And it can't get them, and she knew that you well, now that we look back, now that you've, you know, done all your work. What was going on then? Like, because if I were talking, if you were my client and you were 16, I'd be like, I get it. You're in love. Let's value that.
Sure.
And
on the one hand,
are you shooting yourself in the foot by focusing? Like, plus, you're a good looking kid. You're funny. You're nice. Plenty of other girls would love you, you know. One. Two, what are you doing that's making it hard for, what was it, Ricky?
Kathy.
Kathy, Ricky, to like you back? Like, is it, was your buddy like approaching it differently, you know, from a different attachment angle? You know,
well,
was your disorganized,
super withdrawn.
Was what?
He was super withdrawn.
Like, interesting.
Yeah.
So, you know, were you doing anything? I don't want to blame the victim.
No, not at all.
But looking back, were you doing anything as a and this is actually pertinent to a lot of listeners, I'm guessing, because there's a lot of lonely people out there who have attachment injuries.
Right.
And will be in situations like that where they're just like, you know, what's wrong with me? How come? And looking back, and maybe you've never had a chance to think about
it. This is interesting.
Was there something about your disorganized attachment style internally and behaviorally that led not only to Kathy not being interested in you?
Yeah.
Because maybe there's a part where she was kind of interested in you, but she was turned off by something you were doing.
Yeah.
And or your disorganized attachment made it difficult for you to kind of adjust. Because most people have crushes that go unrequited.
Sure.
But for years, you know, that's and suffering in that way.
That was a theme for me back then.
Yeah.
Chasing, I mean, you could say on the surface, chasing women that were unavailable.
Yeah.
But I did find myself attracted to women who were not available. I do think I probably did a lot of things that would turn her off. Insecurity is not a turn on.
Like, do you think you exhibited that?
Oh, hell yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You wouldn't like me. I'm just...
Moody, broody, at times desperate.
Like angry, like, how come you don't like me?
No. I don't recall ever getting angry with her, but I do recall getting like that sort of desperate, sad, clingy thing.
Like Ducky.
Yeah. And, you know, that's probably just a universal turnoff.
Right.
Period. I think that. And then in terms of me fixating.
Whereas your friend was like all Steve McQueen.
Interesting, because, you know, I remember him and he was so withdrawn. Like, he was silent when I was around, just the two of us. The guy never talked. Yeah. I didn't know what the appeal was.
Clint Eastwood.
Yeah, but this is not like a tough guy. This is just the mild-mannered drummer in the band, right?
But emotionally, he's a Clint Eastwood.
I guess so, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Stoic, I guess you could see him that way. Nice guy. I think I got stuck. Let's see, what would stick me? Shame has got to be a piece of it. And perhaps a self-concept of not worthy. I'm spitballing here. I don't know. Self-concept of not truly worthy, or maybe it's safe to love something that doesn't love you back.
Yeah.
Someone that doesn't love you back. It's sort of safe. You know, there's no risk involved.
Right. I see all that.
Yeah.
I can also absolutely see being broody and being, you know, like giving off a vibe of desperation.
Oh yeah.
And even if it was like 3 times over the span of a year or something
Right.
You know, it wasn't like all the time. It was just like brief moments where maybe you had a couple beers or she, you know, and her, you and her were alone and you were just like, I just got to tell her.
Yeah.
You know,
Yeah. That sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. I could just imagine and her going like, you know, just getting a vibe of just like, whoa, like there's a lot of energy there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I might have liked him otherwise or something like that.
Maybe.
So that's a formative moment for you.
Yeah.
What do you mean? How did it form your personality?
Well, let's see. I liked several people after her who were unavailable.
So it kind of provided a template for having at least some closeness because you were good friends with her.
Yeah, we were good friends.
So you did get that attention.
Yeah.
And so it locked in. I've seen that a lot. It's hard to measure, but I've seen a lot where our first true kind of the closest we get to like that soul connection in teenage years or early 20s becomes often it imprints on us a lot of elements that are really hard to disassociate from from our needs later on.
Yeah.
So that's what happened to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think part of what happened was, sort of, there were three women after that who, over the next 12, 14 years that I was in love with who were unavailable, either because they were dating somebody else or they just weren't interested in me or both. And, one in particular, she and I, we worked at this runaway shelter together right when we finished college. We both got hired at the same time. And I think we had a mutual attraction for one another. But then after a while, she was like not into me and probably for these reasons. And this right before I moved to Seattle, about a week before I moved to Seattle, I went out with her. It was our last time hanging out and saying goodbye. And I was hugging her goodbye. And she said to me, "I wonder if I'm going to regret not dating you." And I said to her, "Well, God, I hope so." she got married. So anyways, and the women that were interested
by the way,
in
if she's probably listening right now, and I'm guessing she does regret it because her husband isn't as emotionally mature as you are.
I think they divorced.
Oh.
Yeah. Anyways, I talked to her once about 10 years ago, and I occasionally see her on those rare occasions I look at Facebook. Anyways, the women that were interested in me, I was afraid of. Mm. I had lots of self-doubt. The first person I was ever involved with any length of time, it lasted 18 months. 9 of it was long distance, and I broke up with her 5 times over the 18 months. We can't do this, and then I'd find myself back. Well, we can't do this. And
well, break that down. Like, what did that feel like? So you're getting consistent love and attention. Uh-huh. That isn't unrequited and isn't, you're not grasping for it. It's just freely
she's
given.
She's just offering.
She's into you.
Yeah.
And how does that, you know, that's the stimulus. How does that get processed in your body and come out with you breaking up with her?
I don't know, except I would feel alternating between anxiety and irritation with her. And I didn't like the feeling of irritation. And I thought, well, maybe, you know, she's not right for me or we're not a good, you know, whatever. And I'd just be like, no, we didn't do this anywhere, you know, and I was probably in a way torturing her, but, you know, two to tango and all that. But, I think that as we got close, I got scared and I did what my dad used to do, which is get cranky and then, pokey, thorny. Uh-huh. You know, like irritable.
Yeah.
And not nice. And I don't like feeling that way.
Yeah.
And I don't like acting that way. And so I would just push away. And then there'd be enough distance and I'd feel like, okay, things are okay. And then I'd be drawn in again because I did love her.
Right.
She was lovely and she was kind to me and she was a lot of really great things about her and she really liked me and it was good. And then we'd connect and I could tolerate that for so long and then have a crisis and pull away. And we did that 5 times. And then the 6th time we broke up was the one she initiated. And that's the one that stuck. Hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I could imagine her doing things to contribute to that.
Yeah,
she
sure.
could be poking at you in certain ways or being enmeshed and not very respectful of your boundaries in certain ways, or was exhibiting some of that desperation that you were doing to other people and they were, you know, so I could see her being partial, but you know, I could also see this being, as you're framing it, I think part of the disorganized attachment as we're labeling it, but essentially the, as one gets close, even though that's often what we're searching for, there's a lot of associations with that are quite scary.
Yeah.
Engulfment, control, criticism, vulnerability, and lack of space for yourself, and I could imagine all that can be quite aggravating.
Yeah, it sucked.
Yeah,
I mean, that experience sucked. I remember these weird thought distortions I would have about her, and they were all push away, push away. And that was right, the first time I was ever in therapy was right around that time. And my therapist said, it sounds like this is the way you're perceiving her is a way to distance yourself from her. First time I ever actually thought about myself psychologically. And it actually was reassuring to think that that were what I was doing. It made it easier to tolerate closeness, at least for a while. So,
and it makes me think that, you know, since Colleen is more of the let's just Netflix and chill, and that's my safe space, that doesn't risk the pursuing engulfment annoyance that you felt with that previous person.
That's a great statement.
That, yeah. Colleen actually, in a way, you benefit from her being a little distant, because it allows you to pursue, as long as it's requited pursuance, enough of the time.
Yeah, right.
Allowed pursuance, received pursuance.
Yeah.
And if she were to truly turn around, you might be like, hey, what the fuck? You know?
I think I still have that vulnerability.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think we all do.
Well, okay.
You're just going to have more of it because of the amount of invasion that you experienced growing up and the risks of being close to people growing up were so much more greater than average, right?
Yeah. Well, is that aggrandizing or is that just true?
What do you mean aggrandizing?
You know, I think there's a level.
Anyone who deeply thinks there's something flawed with them at their core, when there's nothing flawed with them at all, really, I don't think that's aggrandizing anything.
Thank you. That's reassuring.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't shame yourself for your shame. I'll shame you for shaming yourself for your shame. All right, well, let's wrap that up. We only got to halfway through page one of 10 pages.
Hey!
I thought we might get to more, but we didn't.
I think it's farther than we usually get.
Yeah, all right. Well, thanks, patrons, Patrick, Sarah, and Jenna, for asking interesting questions. I know a lot of you asked other questions that we'll try to get to in another episode.
Yeah.
And please take care of yourself, and do not shame. I will shame all of you out there for shaming your shame. And please take care of yourself because
you deserve it.